wonder-working power in the precious...
Incredible as they seem, are not the results of mass hysteria.
You may wish to adjust the dial you're currently tuned into.
The wrong station. Now that the dust has settled, now that the parliamentary hearings are done and Cress and I and all the others cleared of any wrongdoing, now that we're all able to walk around like ordinary people, I sometimes let myself think it's over. And maybe that's for the best, because I don't know what was going on in any of their heads, and I don't know if they deserve the praise or blame for anything that happened. Or for any of the people that they did or did not kill. All I know is what happened in my own head. And I still see the after images at night. Blooms of fire, green and blue, on the black screen inside my head. I'd been in the pen for 2 years when Max Menard got transferred back to my range. Handsome guy. Light-skinned Haitian Quebecer with blue eyes. Max was everybody's friend. Even the white nationalists liked him in a grudging sort of way. But it struck me as odd to see him again. People didn't usually get transferred back in. My cellmate Farouz was a political prisoner, a Red. He'd been in a lot longer than me. People on the range treated him with almost as much respect as the lifers. See that? He told me the afternoon Max got shown back in. That's a setup. Max sat down across from me at lunch a few days later. Hey, long time no see. It was what we all said to each other every day as a joke. The fact that it actually had been about 8 months almost made it funny. Yeah, man, welcome home. I didn't ask why he was back. It was rude to ask questions like that. Feels good to breathe the fresh air again. How's Corfed these days? Yeah, pretty good. Just got a raise. $1.85 an hour. We pulled double shifts sewing uniforms for the army. It was the only way you could buy internet or the occasional can of Coke from the commissary. Look at you, high roller over here. Well, maybe I should take my offer somewhere else. He made as if to get up. But I was already saying, what offer, Max? He leaned in. Armed robbery, right? I leaned back, crossed my arms. It was rude to ask questions like that. Those days are behind me. Sure. But you know how to stick to a plan, follow orders, things like that. You putting together a heist, Max? He laughed. Oh, nothing like that, man. I'm working with the good guys now. They bumped me over from Corfed to CSOX. Better pay, time off your sentence, more interesting work. That's a setup, Farouz had said. Now I understand what he meant. You're a recruiter. He smiled, shrugged. Well, so what? Would you rather sell uniforms? Or wear one. 2 days later, CSOX, the Correctional Services Auxiliary, accepted my application. That night, my last night on the range, Farouz said to me, I think you're crazy. The same people who are doing this to you, you're going to go do their dirty work? I told him that wasn't how I saw it. He laughed. Well, that's how they see it. But back then, I felt like the joke was on him, because the next morning I was the one breathing fresh air, the one looking up at a clear sky, bags packed, handcuffed to the seat of a shuttle, watching the pen fade behind me. MFB Starside wasn't much of an adjustment from the pen. Different uniform, slightly better food, but you were still sleeping in cells, still locked down at night. And though CSOX was mostly siloed from the regular forces, you still met grunts often enough to know that they were the same kind of people that you met inside. Maybe just a few years difference between us and them, on either side. The main difference was that, in the pen, truly dangerous people tended to get taken care of by the lifers. In the forces, they were cultivated. Our first morning, they jacked us into training sims at 0600. I lasted 8 seconds before filling the chamber with vomit. "Not to worry," the petty officer told me. The whole inside was plastic-lined like Grandma's couch, and as I lay face up on the concrete floor outside, they hosed the chamber out, right into sluices on the hangar floor. The plastic was porous enough to absorb the smells, though, and once the instruments heated up, your training pod was like a sauna where someone had poured spoiled milk on the coals. Still, despite long hours in the puke pod, I was almost happy for the first few weeks. I could see the sun every day. I could touch grass. I could even walk out Starside's front gates if I was stupid enough. It was like diet freedom. And what they were training us for, it went beyond my wildest hopes. Each morning, I'd get up early just to go sit and look at our frames, folded up on the tarmac, silhouetted by the rising sun like rows of monks in contemplation. Even crouched up, they were more than 40 feet at the shoulder. Monumental, statues of God on the avenue, all chrome-bright with polished alloy, throwing back the light of neon sky, bristling with countermeasure spikes like feathered dinosaurs. I loved to watch reflected clouds drifting across their chrome. These were Dysnoia Mark II frames, Advent Arms and Atomics. Titanalloy chassis, all-theater movement suite, solid-state reactor which you could really punish when you wanted to go fast. Agnite coolant system so you wouldn't blow up when you did. Brockenfield, Poggendorf, and Zollner countermeasures so the frames were almost impossible to hit. And even if you did, the Mark IIs were flashed against hard light with hexarodium and layered with pico-kooft plating against kinetics. I wasn't the only one who liked to sit out in the morning cool, watching the sunrise behind them. One pilot from the women's CSOX parallel was always out there before me in the morning, sitting with her back to a trash can, watching the great machines sleep. Her name was Cressida, I found out later. Cress. She wore the ruins of life on her face. Scarred cheeks, busted nose. But her eyes burned under their dark brows. And I think she must have been terribly beautiful before she became what she was. We came to know Cress through her tradecraft. Once you could do 5 minutes agility work without making the puke pod smell worse, you were thrown into simulations against each other. I turned out to be pretty good, often ranked second or third in the range. A lot of people struggle with hard light because there's no recoil, no feedback to it. But I found a knack for it. The trick is to feel the feedback in your own fingers on the trigger. Da-da-da. You want that triple burst rhythm. One beam for the flashing, one to superheat the plate, one to ionize. You have to land all three in exactly the same spot to score a kill. But once I had the rhythm in my hands, I could do it consistently, even when flying backwards. The others thought that this was a cowardly way to fight and gave me the call sign Sparrow. Cress, though, she didn't bother much with projectiles or hard light. Just got in close and tore your frame apart with her hands. Even in the training sim, this experience is violating. You know, the frame is your body. It becomes your body, if only for a few seconds. A lot of men on the range took it personally, especially the ones who were in because they'd hurt women. Well, maybe they were meant to. But they hated her, and some of them fell in love with her, and that made them hate her even more. Cress was always ranked number one. Her call sign was Kaiser. We were allowed TV at MFB Starside, and we watched the war break out live. Green lights over the cities of Priet Prayin, slow-falling stars and the whine of engines bigger than a house. Gun thunder shaking the camera so much you thought you could rest your hand against the TV screen and feel it. The distant incandescence of two frames colliding under firmaments of smoke. "This is it, boys," someone murmured. "They're gonna put us in the fight." Maybe the convoy really was at constant risk of attack. Maybe it just made economic sense to leave us hanging there. We spent the whole 8-day transit to Priet Prayin sealed in our unpowered frames. I'd spent time in solitary before, but nothing could have prepared me. 8 days of darkness, sealed in a plastic envelope, the breathing walls pressing around your face and chest until you want to scream and scream. But it doesn't matter how long you scream, because once you're done screaming, you're still alone in the squeezing dark, stifled by the heat of your own stinking breath. Nothing to do for 8 whole days but go insane. I was gone most of the time. I was nowhere. Came back at 8-hour intervals when grape paste slid down the tube into my nose. Felt like drowning every time. And the sweat, my God. And when they pulled me out, dehydrated at Dagana Heights FOB, my back was covered in sores from where the sweat had gone rancid between me and the plastic cover of the flight couch. I wept on the tarmac as they hosed me down. It didn't matter because I was a prisoner and not a person. For 2 whole days, they left me on the floor of a prefab rig to put myself together. After the cockpit, that tiny room felt so big it made me dizzy. On the 3rd morning, they herded me out under teal skies. The silhouette of frames against the rising sun now filled me with unbearable panic. I could not go back inside that body bag. Suddenly I was screaming and trying to claw my way back to the cell. But CSOC's flight crews are all drafted from the military police. They wrenched my shoulders, struck me in the kidneys, and forced me up into the blackness of the cockpit while I struggled and moaned. I remember one of them using a power driver to bolt my restraints into place. I sobbed and pounded at the handrests as they sealed me in. A heavy click, a hiss of gas as the cabin pressurized. Then came the sudden cold of subsync needles thudding into my brainstem and sacral spine. The twitch of polyurethane as dopamine and epinephrine spasmed into my mind. Suddenly, I wondered why I'd ever wept, even once in my life. I stood, no longer trapped, but free. My own body, I realized, had been the real cage, and now I was liberated into form of chrome and lightning. My real form, real body, real self. I was large enough to pluck suns and drown them into the sandy sea. I could have smeared the flight crew into the tarmac as an afterthought. But why? They'd only been taking me where I belonged. Instead, I raised glowing eyes to the horizon. All seemed suddenly possible. The sufferings I'd undergone belonged to another body, not my own. I was in violet chrome, and would never feel pain again. I wondered what to do next, and a woman's voice spoke cool in my ear. "Good morning, pilot. This is Control." She was aptly named, She sounded collected and sure. Good morning, Control. This is a test mission, Pilot. We're going to put this Mark II through its paces to make sure both frame and pilot have undergone transit in condition green. Some small part of me raged in the distant corner of my mind. Condition green. After 8 days zipped into a body bag? Is there an issue, Pilot? But the sound of that distant voice was drowned by the rush of dopamine. No issue, Control. Condition green. After that, I came to know the bliss and liberty of speed and flight. No fear of closeness in the suit, no fear of vastness in the sky. So at one with the machine, the jet stream screamed across my chrome skin like a lover's breath at climax. So at one with the sky, I could feel it thinning with the sun's heat at near horizon, cooling with the night's blue at far. So at one with the other frames, I could feel the pilots nested like a beating heart inside each one, that I could feel the shift of color on their mirrored skins, scarlet, cyan, fuchsia, gold, as they spun on an infinite wind. I ran into Cress back down on the tarmac. Alone of us all, she wasn't flushed or shaking, radiant in the eyes. "What's the matter?" I asked. "We finally flew." She gave me a blank smile as MPs herded her back toward the women's range. "You really think that was you?" Alarm came at 0300. And I thought it was another drill until I was sprinting across the tarmac, and the bloom of flak from our guns was like dawn, and their rumble was an earthquake in my chest. Best time yet, 52 seconds caught to cockpit, with Control shouting something in my deafened ears, and the text scrolling jagged on my HUD, enemy frames waypoint by waypoint, lights shrieking across the sky, green eruptions as one of our frames was killed, half standing. Someone's bones to be smelted from the wreckage afterward. Who has time to think about motivations at an hour like that? I was airborne. I was in ragged formation, at point this time, not my accustomed spot near Cress's 4 o'clock. Pure dark, moonless under heavy skies, but the enemy frames were a generation older than ours, and their countermeasures couldn't fully scatter our telemetry. They showed up, distant blurs of green on screen, semi-human, shuddering, shifting, shifting. 15 hostiles confirmed, said Control. Estimate 86 probability refurb Tier 1 Nomad units. Threat level low to moderate. Advise aggressive engagement. But I didn't need the cool voice to tell me that. I already had the chemical rush. As the enemy frames expanded on my screen, I could see that they were trying to withdraw. Just a night raid, a hit-and-run attack. But what they weren't counting on, or maybe there was no accounting for, was our technological edge. Solid-state reactor. Ignite coolant. We were already on top of them, and though their countermeasures made it hard to land a shot, I was able to force their rear guard into cover at a line of hills. The firefight which came next dragged out through a black hour. Hillsides killed with shrapnel and spall. 700-year-old olive groves hard-lighted into powder and matchsticks. The Nomad pilots were seasoned. But we had raw supremacy. Two of theirs went down for each of ours, until false dawn greened and the Nomads tried to pull back again, their reserve fighting a costly action to buy the others time. They did pretty well. By the time Cress ripped the last surviving rearguard mech in half, the Nomads had scattered. We broke off into two frame elements to pursue, but the enemy pilots knew their countryside, and with a head start, nearly half a dozen managed to clear out. Our own target dropped off sensors shortly before sunup. We searched, reckless for it. Frantic. Control demanded results. My element wingman made the mistake of going airborne and drew 3 Lark mines, the rhythm of their explosions like my fingers on the trigger. 1 Lark would have been enough to kill a Nomad, but the Mark II emerged from those 3 fireballs with only countermeasure spikes fried. Laughter crackling over comms as I shouted at him to take cover. But CSOC's combat doctrine prioritizes kills. He stayed airborne, trying to get a sensor lock. The Nomad locked him first. Crack. Coil gun, super heavy. Turned him into sunburst with a single round. and rained his molten chrome along a mile of desert floor. But the sonic boom revealed his position, half buried itself in the dust of a dry wadi, and as he struggled for an ox weapon, I overclocked and came down with that triple tap of hard light. Silence. Enemy frame neutralized. Control confirmed. I felt pretty good. Now the horizon was light, and against its faint green I could see the towers of smoke we'd built in the night. Beneath my feet, the killed nomad was only a .66, about two-thirds the size of my Mark II. Khaki-painted, scored and dull from rock and sand and fragments of exploding glass. A neat, clean chasm in the unit's chest from my hard light. A few meters from fuel cell, magazine, or cockpit. Maybe I'd hit the processor. A lucky shot, I guess. Enemy pilot still active, said Control. I could see that. Down through the pitted glass of his cockpit. A kid about the age of my little brother. He was looking up at me calmly. Just waiting to die. Recommend termination, said Control. Well, I'd no interest in that. So I shouldered my hard light and turned a jet off in the direction of Dagana FOB. That's when the joints of my body grinded shut. Recommend termination. I'm not going to shoot some helpless kid, Control. Direct order given. Terminate enemy pilot. Order not received. But I guess Control's mind was as made up as mine. Pilot condition amber, she said, assuming control. Then my body spun without volition. The hard light unholstered itself. I met the pilot's gaze as my hands. You have to understand, it was my hands that did this. Ended his life in a blast of white silence. I stared down at that empty space for a long time. The whole frame trembled in just the same way as my body trembled inside it. Updating brief. A chime sounded. A new waypoint appeared on screen. Enemy position confirmed. Green light to engage. I closed my eyes. The position highlighted on my map was a village. Direct order given. Clear enemy position at waypoint bet. My cheeks were wet, as if the boy's blood had splashed up onto my face. I could still see his eyes, that cool, steady gaze. Pilot, respond. Then, after a moment, pilot condition amber, assuming control. Then my body tensed of its own accord, and I was airborne, hanging like a bird of prey above that place where real people lived. Normal people, non-combatants, people with pets and families and hopes. People who existed. I won't tell you about what happened next. We took heavy casualties on that raid, near 40%. But CSOC's doctrine prioritizes kills, so the action was ruled a success. New auxiliaries were brought in, survivors consolidated on a single range. I didn't know if any of the others experienced what I did. For most of us, it had been our first action. Maybe that's enough to explain why everyone was so quiet for the next 2 days. On the morning of the third, Cressida showed up at my cell. I can guess what happened. I glanced up to see her crouching outside the bars. Unlocked, but I had no desire to go outside. I curled up tighter on my cot. We killed people. That's what happened, I said. I mean, in the broader sense. Here's what I think. Control can pilot the frames just fine without us. But nobody likes that. Two on the nose. So the great powers say to each other, you've got to have a human do the killing for you. and they all signed treaties with each other saying that you've got to have a human pilot in your frames. Of course, nobody actually wants to respect those treaties, but bad PR is bad PR. You need a fig leaf. Enter Seasox and the brave pilots of the Correctional Auxiliary. It was by far the most I'd ever heard her say at once. I stared at her. She smiled, or at least tightened her face, and stood and was gone before I could ask her how she knew all that, or why she'd signed up with Seasox if she did. The war on Priet Prayin lasted another 6 months, and then after that another 30 years, but I wasn't part of that phase. After the 6 month pacification, you didn't really need frames anymore, except for show. Guns and helicopters in the night would do just fine. It felt like much longer than 6 months for those of us on the flight couch. The alarms blaring at 4 a.m., the MPs kicking you and screaming in your face as they dragged you to the cockpit once again, the cold penetration of the neural spike, and then the warped homecoming to that body. So strong, so agent, so out of your control. I watched my own hands do unthinkable things in those months. I watched them rip the cockpit off a Nomad and use one thumb to smear the pilot like a carpet beetle. I watched them light up the supports of a dam upstream of a city where 30,000 people lived. I watched them punch through the walls of a school where children were taking shelter. I didn't do any of these things, but I watched myself do them. I could still feel the actions in my hands, even though they weren't rightly my hands. It feels like I did them, and no amount of therapy or medication can get the sensations out of me, because they were ultimately real. 5 months of nightmare. I tried to stop eating in order to feel some sense of agency, but even in my own body, I just couldn't. Piloting a frame takes an enormous amount out of you. The body needs calories afterward, and every time I tried to stop eating, I quickly gave into the hunger. So I started using my fingernails to carve little symbols in my skin instead. But Seasox took that agency away from me too. First, they removed my fingernails. Then, when I started to bite instead, they took my teeth. And then, in the 6th month, a final mission. Soft targets only by that stage in the war. Any form of mechanized resistance on Priet Prayin had been seared or torn away by my hard light or Kress's hands. No more nighttime actions. We moved in the day now. Yet another hilltop. Yet another town blown. Tiny flecks of humanity blowing this way and that as the familiar cry of distant klaxons wailed. Control adjusted the weapon in my hands. Took aim. Reticules lit gold and green on my heads-up display. I watched it unfold with dry dispassion. My tears had turned to salt a long, long time before. Then, unexpectedly, Control spoke. "Would you like to do the honors?" I was so dissociated it took me a moment to even realize she was talking to me. "You mean to pull the trigger? To kill those people?" "Yes, yourself. To do what you're here for, pilot. For once." I was surprised when I didn't say no immediately. My dry tongue passed itself over dry lips. I considered what it would feel to control something. To do something, even if it was something I couldn't live with. "If you don't," said Control, "I'll pull the trigger anyway. So it doesn't matter either way." She paused. "Wouldn't you like to feel in control?" I don't know why she made this offer. Why she chose to play Satan. She was just a glorified chatbot. No real volition, I think. Only the illusion, as it were, of control. I can't ask her now, either way. She was deleted. Accidentally, according to CSOX, in the lead-up to the hearings. So I don't know what was in her head, or if she deserves the blame for all these things that happened, or if she was just a tool after all, or another prisoner, if something in her lived. I don't know any of that. All I know is what was in my own head. That one time when I pulled the trigger. After the story broke, it took 8 years for the cycles of news and hearings and faulty justice to wind themselves down. We pilots, if you can call us that, didn't keep in touch afterward. We had nothing to share, since our actions hadn't been our own. Or so we claimed. I saw Cressida on the stand, and sometimes in the galleries at hearings, but I never spoke with her again until 10 years after Priyat Prayin. Unexpectedly. Call it serendipity if you like, or whatever the opposite of that might be. I ran into her at 2:30 in the morning in a dive bar on Catulven. Whatever vestiges of beauty she'd once had were fully ruined by then. Her breath was heavy and laughter forced as she draped herself across me at the bar. Made the proposition at the end of the night, even though she knew I didn't swing that way. Then eventually hailed a ride and reeled for the door. But on her way out, she steadied herself against the doorframe and turned to look at me with knowing eyes. Crooked a beckoning finger in my direction. And drunk, too drunk to have full control of my actions, I staggered over into her cloud of paint-thinner breath. She leaned forward, cracked lips parted beside my ear. She whispered, "I was in control the entire time." And then, "I know that you were too." After that, she kissed me hard on the lips and turned to the night, the reeking slum town air. Despite her drunken sway, Cressida's footsteps landed like a frame's. Her strides were like the strides of world-spanning engines. Her footsteps fell like they meant something. Like they were hers. The Wrong Station is made possible with the generous support of our listeners on Patreon. Visit today at patreon.com/thewrongstation. You can also support us by leaving a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever it is you tune into the show. This week's episode, The Feeling of Control, was written by Alexander Saxton and performed by Anthony Botello. Thank you to Paul Ainsworth, Sky Moore, Tony D, DameTrain05, your friend Dan Du, and Rebecca Gates for helping us keep the lights, well, off. The Wrong Station is co-produced by Alexander Saxton, Anthony Botello, and Jacob Duarte Spiel, with music composed and performed by Alan Citrin and arranged for the viola and performed by Viola Schmidt. You can follow The Wrong Station on social media, at The Wrong Station, and email us at thewrongstation@gmail.com. And until next time, thank you for listening.